on this episode of Skeptico.
What does this say about our relationship with the deceased? It's hard to even fathom. I mean, we have enough problems dealing with the relationships of the people who are here with us living. Now you're telling us in a way that we have to worry about the unseen intergenerational relationships four generations back of some grandfather I never met.
I mean, definitely, that's a great question. And it's at the core of what we're doing is that the ancestors are not all okay. That some of the ancestors are okay and they're in a loving relationship with us. But when the ancestors are not okay, and often they are not, they show up in our lives as our symptoms.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today we talk about families and what a pain in the neck they can be. Seriously, we all know they can be. Don't get me wrong, I treasure my family. I treasure my relationship with my wife. But it's difficult at times. My kids, they're awesome, except when they're not awesome. My brother, sister, aunts, uncles, brother-in-laws, and all that extended family I hardly ever see, they're awesome, and they're sometimes challenging, and we all know how that can be. And we also know that sometimes it can all get to be a little bit too much, and it can drive us looking for help. Today's guests are two psychotherapists that have spent a good deal of their time trying to help individuals and family systems get back on track. But what really makes them interesting and relevant to our show on Skeptico is they've shattered the model of what family means by incorporating in the growing inescapable body of evidence suggesting that consciousness extends beyond death and that maybe those who are deceased are still among us. So if you thought you had problems with your family, stick around because you're liable to find out you have problems with a lot more folks in that lineage than you ever dreamed about. Now, one thing you will hear in this interview is that I did meet Dan and Emily when they came out here to San Diego, and I actually went through one of these extended family therapy sessions with them. It was really quite interesting. It wasn't planned. It just kind of spontaneously came up after our conversation. And you will hear me reference that several times in the show. In all, I've gained a lot from working with Dan and Emily. I really, really appreciate where they're coming from and how bravely they've tried to chart this new course in psychotherapeutic work that incorporates in the growing body of knowledge we have about consciousness and extended consciousness. Just imagine the progress we could have if more people were willing to push the boundaries the way that Dan and Emily are. Hope you enjoy the interview. Today we welcome Dr. Dan Booth-Cohen and clinical social worker Emily Volden to Skeptico. Dan and Emily, and this phrasing here, folks, is from their website, merge advanced consciousness and spiritual principles into psychotherapeutic practice. Interesting, hey? So I met Dan and Emily while they were here in San Diego for a international professional conference that they do. And what planned on being a brief 30-minute chat between us turned into this full-blown four-hour demonstration of this systemic family constellations counseling thing that we're going to talk about and that they do. So ever since then, I've really been looking forward to having them on, and I'm very delighted to welcome both of you here to Skeptico today. Dan and Emily, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much, Alex, for having us.
Thanks, Alex. We're excited to be on the show with you.
Great. So let's start with this, I think, what might sound a little bit strange to people when they first encounter the term, systemic family constellations. Briefly, what is that?
So systemic family constellations are an experiential process. They come from three main streams. One stream is from systemic family therapy that developed in primarily in California, starting in the 1950s and 60s.
So hold on, let me jump right in there, because before we get too far along. So family therapy, I think we all understand that. I have a problem with my teenage son. I have a problem with another family member. Divorce, adoption, all sorts of things happen. People come in and they want family counseling, right? That's the general kind of ballpark that we're talking about, right?
Well, this was systemic family therapy, which was a particular strand, and it originated when they would treat a family member with a mental health system a symptom, schizophrenia or manic depressive, and they would successfully treat the symptom, and they would find that the exact symptoms then jumped to another family member.
Wow. So that's what systemic family counseling is?
Those are the origins, was the idea that they had to treat an entire family, that the symptom was actually alive in the family, and it embedded in one person, and you could treat that person, but it wouldn't remove the symptom from the family field, that it would then just migrate to a different family member. So the systemic family therapy was the idea of looking at the family system as a whole and treating it as a whole rather than pointing to an individual member and thinking they're the ones with a problem.
I'm sorry, just let me make sure I understand this. And its origins were from seriously diagnosed medical conditions, or has it then broadened since then, or where are we really at in that?
It grew for about 30 years in the United States into the 80s, and then it was really crushed by the movement towards cognitive behavioral theory and therapy and psychiatric medications. And there were some kind of inside politics within psychology and psychotherapy, and it's pretty much disappeared in the last 30 years in the United States, but it's remained active in other countries. So it migrated to Europe beginning in the 1980s and has continued there and comes back to the States in the form of family constellations. And that's one stream of three that combine into family constellations.
There's a way where when you hear the word systemic family constellations, there's the word systemic. When you think about systemic family therapy, the word systemic is speaking to this consciousness of an emotional legacy.
Well, let me tell you what happened to me when I met y'all and I talked to you in San Diego, and it was an awesome talk, and you guys are doing fantastic work. First of all, you're trying to help people. So people come to you for counseling because something is not working in their life, and you try and help them. And what I heard from you and felt from you is this excitement that you have because you've found something that really, really works. And it seems to be much more effective than some of the other techniques and protocols that you've learned with your extensive training that you have. And then what's particularly interesting to me for the purposes of this show, Skeptico, and what we explore is that you guys have jumped on the other side of this whole consciousness issue and have kind of said, okay, after-death communication seems to be real. There seems to be a continuity of consciousness after death. So, of course, we have to bring that back in and find out what that means to our therapy practices. So let's just go about that work. And you haven't looked back with what your colleagues and what other people might be saying about, oh my God, how can you make those assumptions? That's just craziness. And the thing that I sense that you're getting into, Emily, is there are some ways to connect that idea that after-death communication should be brought into the therapy process. There are some ways to maybe connect that from a biological standpoint and from some other research. But you also are kind of dealing with just that huge leap of saying, hey, extended consciousness, after-death communication, spiritual practices are all now on the table. So Tell me, first of all, is that an accurate assessment? How would you tweak that maybe a little bit? And what is that like, making that huge leap to this other side of the chasm here and bringing in all these consciousness and spiritual ideas into therapy practice?
This is a very live question between Emily and I, and in our practice, there's one stance that you can kind of stand in the doorway between the big institutions that hold our healthcare and our mental health, of between pharmaceutical companies and psychotherapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, and then universities. And it's a pretty closed system, that consciousness is a product of the brain. And so there's a spot where there's a doorway that opens up and says, hey, guys, look here. You got to see this, kind of keeping one foot on the boat and one foot on the dock, and trying to encourage the people from the other side to kind of get on the boat with you. And there's another stance that just says, hey, we're going to sail away, because the people that are on the dock, they're not getting on the boat. And we can spend our whole lives trying to entice people to get on the boat with us. And all that energy is by and large going to be futile, that there will be people who are ready to get on the boat, and we're going to sail away, and they can come if they're attracted. We're making room for them to join us, but we're not beating our heads against a wall trying to argue with the thousands of professors and practitioners who are going to say that what we're doing is not based in a solid evidence.
Okay, let's drill into that for a second. It might be interesting. Let's play that game. Let's say you have one foot on the dock and one foot on the boat. How would you talk to me? How would you bring me over? How would you connect me with your work in a way that I could relate to on a somewhat scientific basis, in, or even just on a traditional therapeutic basis? Because we have to acknowledge, first right out of the gate, that there's a lot of therapy that doesn't connect directly with the materialistic, reductionistic model that the rest of the science game is playing. So just from that standpoint, how would you connect with me as just a therapist or a psychiatrist who was introduced to some of these ideas? How would you try and bring me on board, if you were? Just play that game a little bit. What would you say?
I this is actually a serious answer. It may sound flip, but the serious answer is I would have people listen to Skeptico. Just have them go to your library and listen to the shows. Listen to the library that you've put together, Alex, and it's the most convincing argument I think could be made. You've talked to dozens or hundreds of people from all sides around this issue, and if you put it all together, I think it's very convincing that the boat floats and it needs to be taken seriously.
Now, I agree with you, Dan, and that's great to hear, and that's super nice of you to say. But, so here's how I break it down. Like we talked about this when you were in San Diego. So, you might do that. You might point people to Julie Bischel and say, hey, look, she's done this hardcore research on after-death communication. It seems to be happening. You might point people to Alan Botkin and say, look, here's a guy who's working at the vet hospital in Chicago, and he's actually connected people with verifiable means of after-death communication. Or you could say, a guy I had on, Michael Nam, and he's, the terminal lucidity, which is, hey, you go into any nursing home or hospice facility and talk to an experienced nurse and they'll tell you, yeah, this happens. People are in a coma or suffer severe Alzheimer's, and a few minutes before they die, they sit up and they gain this lucidity. All these things point to what you're talking about. I guess what I'd like to understand better is, I love the metaphor that you painted. You either got to sail the boat or you're in this impossible position of having one foot on the deck and one foot in the boat. Further elaborate on that landscape, if you will, because I think it's interesting given what we're talking about here.
So, Alex, I was an ADHD specialist for years and built a thriving psychotherapy practice treating the avalanche of symptoms that were commonly attributed to ADHD or culture-induced stress. And I was making phenomenal, progress working with a cognitive behavioral therapy model.
Tell people a little bit, what would be cognitive therapy techniques? What would typically stuff would you do for someone who had ADHD?
In the past, I would teach a way of being that promotes and sustains someone's best self, their most meaningful relationships, their highest potential, while still managing to live in the fast current of everyday life. I used, you know, well-regulated medication, nutritional support and education, teaching people coping symptoms and communication skills, emotion regulation techniques, mindfulness, all those things that we hear and we read about in Psychology Today. And that what I found is that as human evolution is growing, as science is expanding, and we're learning more and more about the impact of psychotropic medication, and we're not finding long-term results, we're looking deeper into what's underneath these symptoms. What is it that's actually contributing to the disturbance that is living in our hearts? So instead of teaching clients coping skills and behavioral techniques to overcome their ADHD, I started to look into what is at the root of the problem. What are the roots of the traumas that are creating this distractible way of living? I'm not saying that there isn't a neurological disorder that is connected to ADHD, or that there aren't neurological deficits that are connected to schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or any of the other severe mental illnesses. But what I found is I was introduced to family constellations, and in that process I found that we're not only the accumulation of our personal experiences or the accumulation of our biological predisposition for mental health, that we're also beings that exist within a larger fabric of collective consciousness, that there is consciousness after death, and that the problems and disturbances in our lives, especially those that cannot be easily remedied, those that we're seeking therapy for or seeking medication for or treatment of some form, are often the after effects of inherited trauma. And they live in this consciousness orbiting around us and within our bodies. So what Dan and I are doing are using the heart as an organ of perception, where you use this core part of your body to tune in, to identify the specific traumas from prior generations that continue to affect the living descendants. And we tune in to somebody might come to us with social anxiety or ADHD or difficulties in their relationship. And we use our body to tune in, to perceive consciousness that endures beyond death. So when shrouded in secrecy, shame, and guilt, the impact of prior generations' traumas appear as present generations' emotional disturbances, chronic physical symptoms, painful relationship patterns. What we're finding in systemic family constellations is that there's a field of consciousness around us. And when you step into that which has not been acknowledged, the subconscious or the unspoken traumas or the unresolved pain of those that have come before us that have died, or those that have come before us that are still living but haven't spoken their pain or their trauma or haven't acknowledged it or healed it, if someone's pushed out of the family, somebody's excluded, oftentimes it's the symptoms of that person that live on in the descendants.
Okay, Dan, what would you add to that? I mean, again, I want you guys to kind of step back and kind of hear this from the standpoint of someone who's open to the idea of extended consciousness, but is probably going to be, like I was, a little bit thrown with the idea of the certainty that this transgenerational trauma is really what's at the root of these problems. How would you win me over in that regard?
You know, it's how invested are you in your own suffering? How invested are you on standing on the boat?
Okay, but there's this growing interest in complementary medicine, alternative medicine, all those things that are out there. And there's also, if we do kind of step onto the boat with you and say, okay, there's this extended consciousness realm, there's even some techniques that are cropping up that incorporate that into, as which you are a part of. I mean, some people just take it into their own hands and say, well, forget all that. I'm going to go get a medium reading. Forget all that. I'm going to go get a past life regression. Two things that you could do to similarly try and resolve these issues. So, man, I am totally with you, Dan. I appreciate what you're saying about how our institutionalized medicine has, because of convenience sake and mainly because of profit sake, had this need to reduce everything down to a pill. I can write a prescription really quick, send you out the door. Everybody makes money. Everybody's happy. We all know that's a failed model that's collapsing under its own weight.
But it's not collapsing, and it depends on consciousness being located in the brain. No one's going to take that pill unless they believe that their consciousness is in their brain and that the problems that they have regarding their emotions, their behaviors, their relationships, their minds, that is brain-based, and then the pill. But if you think that consciousness is a phenomenon that we're immersed in, why would you take a pill? Why would anybody take a pill for it? It's ridiculous.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think we got to be a little bit careful, right? I mean, because some of the pills, I mean, we're constantly altering this 3-pound thing of jelly up there that seems to be somehow interacting with that consciousness field. We don't know how any of that stuff works, but we do know that there are some medications that do change the filter in a way that is helpful for people, at least for some period of time. And I don't want to get into the details of that because that's your...
The pills work. I'm not saying the pills don't work. They work beautifully for many, many people. Many of those 60 million people, the pills are a godsend for them. The pills are very helpful. I'm not saying that they're not.
But they're children. You know, their children then begin to inherit the same symptoms that the pills are numbing in them. So that there's a way where, you know, research in epigenetics is suggesting that the impact of traumatization is heritable across multiple generations. The findings in behavioral epigenetics have broad implications in the field of mind-body medicine. At the same time, all of our current modalities for addressing inheritable trauma are treating it in a way that it reduces the symptoms, but it doesn't necessarily release the root. What is the cause of these symptoms? So if somebody's struggling with profound anxiety and they take a pill, the pill can help to rebalance some of the chemistry in their brain. It can help to rebalance some of the ways that they're in relationship with people or with themselves or with life or with their purpose. But it doesn't actually explain why the anxiety is there in the first place. Where is that genetic predisposition coming from? And how did it get turned on?
Okay, so hold on a minute, because I think this is a useful alley to go down as the epigenetics thing, you know, because a lot of people aren't going to be really totally up to date on the research that you're referencing. Dan, from a 40,000 foot view, what is epigenetics? Why is it relevant to behavior? And then we'll stop there, and then we'll go into this, why you think there's a transgenerational aspect to that that needs to be addressed. But first of all, basics, epigenetics, and behavior.
Well, epigenetics is this physical science of the enzymes that surround the DNA in each cell, and they're effectively switches. They're genetic switches, but unlike the DNA, those codes are fixed in gestation or at conception, they're fixed. The epigenetic switches are plastic. They can turn on and off, and they change during a person's lifetime. They can be switched on and off, and they carry genetic memory.
So give us an example. If I'm a rager, I have a horrible anger problem, and that developed probably because of some childhood trauma I had or the way that I was raised or whatever we're going to point our finger at, let's just fill that in and say that's the identified cause of that. Now, you're saying that that can actually have a biologically identifiable effect.
The two classic examples of in epigenetics that are, you know, they're well accepted. One comes from McGill University. The other comes out of Sweden. They have a mouse. They created a synthesized odor, and they exposed the mice to the odor, and then they shocked them, and they repeated that until the mice went into a trauma response when they smelled the odor. And then they bred the mice 7 generations, and the seventh generation of mouse had an aversion to the odor. So that's, and then they identified the enzyme in those bred mice, the seventh generation mice. They found the enzyme, the switch that was turned on, the trauma response that was turned on, that was in reaction to the odor.
And they separated the babies from the mother, so there was no learned response. So for seven generations, you know, this initial, you know, the first generation was exposed to the smell. Children were separated at birth. The baby mice were, phobic of the smell without ever being taught to be phobic. That inherited, and that's an environmental stimuli that came in a traumatic way, and, you know, created a fear, a conditioned fear within the first generation. And that conditioned fear turned into a phobia that continued. So the premise they're making is that, you know, social phobia is something that's inheritable because of some environmental trauma. And with the condition of the world today and the amount of war that our community is in, it's, you know, our children and our children's children and our children's children's children are all inheriting the trauma.
Well, not to get sidetracked, but it's really kind of worse than that, as many historians have pointed out. I mean, we are the ancestors of more or less sociopathic kind of mass murderers. I mean, if you think of the people in the battlefield, you know, whether it was the Huns or the Vikings, I mean, they were lopping off people's heads in kind of hand-to-hand combat where their arms were up to their elbows in blood in a way that we can't even imagine. And those are our descendants, because those are the people who won. So you might even make the case that the trauma that we experience from war is probably less than previous generations. But your point is extremely well taken, and that's that these emotional events in our life are somehow, in some way we don't totally understand, but we can scientifically identify, are being passed on to our descendants.
Let me just mention the Swedish study quickly. So, because that was a human study, and they did research in an isolated area in Sweden, and they had detailed records of famines going back about 150 years, and they were able to correlate children that were born in the trauma years. They could correlate that those children's grandchildren had a predilection towards gluttony, obesity, and type 2 diabetes.
Right. Wow. Amazing.
And, you know, we're seeing this profoundly in terms of couples' relationships as well. That's actually one of my, you know, favorite things to work with in our clinical practice, and many of the people that we train are couples and family therapists, because couples have been reenacting the same arguments for years. You get to a point in your relationship where it's no matter what you do, how you go about it, there's this kind of reenactment of the same struggles, just, you know, wrapped in a different material. And what we're finding is that it's that they're holding the hidden patterns of ancestral trauma.
I want to come back to this epigenetic thing, and I want to try and understand how therapy 101 or your typical mainstream family therapy, how are they incorporating in the epigenetic reality? Are they dealing with that at all?
The place where the mainstream therapy is unwilling to get on the boat, and you can see it in this movement of complementary medicine, not so much alternative medicine, but complementary medicine that's working its way into hospitals with mindfulness meditation and other types of relaxation techniques, et cetera. You see it in epigenetics, that the big breakdown in epigenetics is that the scientists are insisting that there is a physical transmission of the information that is held in these epigenetic switches. And of course, they can't find it. Rupert Sheldrake has spoken about and written about this topic much more knowledgeably than I can, but people that listeners that are familiar with him and his work can reference that and get a very good explanation of it, that they're not putting in the field. They won't acknowledge that this is a field phenomenon.
Right.
And they continue to insist that it is a material phenomenon. But there's no explanation for how that could occur.
Let me just interject for a second. For mm-hmm. many of the folks listening, know Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, biologist originally from Cambridge, has done some amazing work in this notion that he has of morphic resonance, that somehow there is this field that carries with it knowledge and information from the past into the future. And as you just alluded to, would seem to fit nicely with what you're finding there. So with that, please return and tell me then, how is the therapy community dealing with epigenetics? Or is it kind of in this separate category here because, oh, that's all a biological thing because we don't have to worry about it from a psychotherapeutic standpoint because it's really in somebody's biology? Is it like a separate kind of camp there thing?
For the most part, most of mainstream psychotherapy and psychology is not moving this way. The majority is, you know, locked into the mainstream. There are, you know, the Alan Botkins and there's other people at the edge. I don't mean to say that we're the only ones. There are you know, many practitioners that are finding ways to integrate mediumship with psychotherapy or after death communication or other types of yoga and meditation that is not, you know, locked into the kind of the atheistic meditation, but a more spiritual meditation, and they're integrating that into psychotherapy. So there are pathways that are opening up.
And let's be honest. I would say that using family systemic constellations doesn't breed a really economically sound clinical practice, because after 2 to 3 sessions, people's symptoms are gone. And, you know, my practice, I'm now training and teaching more than I'm doing clinical work, because it's a new intake after a new intake after a new intake versus being able to take people's money every week for a year or 2 years. It becomes a much briefer therapy. I'm not proud to acknowledge that there's this large industry behind psychotherapy, but there is. And so keeping people stuck for longer periods of time is much more appealing to a psychotherapist who's trying to make it in this in the clinical world than a short-term brief therapy. I think the other thing that I would just acknowledge is that there's a lot of, you know, Dan and I break consciousness down to first, second, and third dimension consciousness. There's many ways to do that, to, you know, break down consciousness. But we're basically saying first dimension consciousness is ordinary. Second dimension consciousness is ancestral, and third dimension consciousness is spiritual. And what we find is there's the typical modalities deal with first dimension consciousness, you know, your stories about your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your wife, your children, you know, whatever is there. And then, or third dimension consciousness, you know, how to access the spiritual realms, how to feel God behind you, or how to be with the wind and this earth and feel a sense of connection to something beyond you. You know, that rarely are people moving into the taboo of talking about the consciousness of the dead that are present. It makes you, you know, there's ancient codes and taboos against this. So it creates this fear for practitioners to step into this realm that they might be called crazy. They might be said to be doing voodoo, or, you know, there's a level of reputation that psychotherapists want to cling to that keeps them in the good graces of society and makes them trustworthy. But in essence, we're working in a way, in a much more narrow way. And it's, it comes from huge oppression, ancient oppression, from some of the more religious paradigms.
I think that's kind of interesting, first, second, third kind of thing. I guess I'm still back just leaving the dock. We keep returning to that same metaphor, and I'm trying to kind of move it a little bit slower in that, you know, I think this thing with epigenetics is really interesting, because I think it ties into the real underlying problem that we're trying to overcome from a scientific kind of the culture of science kind of thing, in that, you know, we have this new discovery, the implications are pretty profound, and we don't want to deal with them, so we kind of shuffle it off into this little category and try and understand it in this way. So what I think is interesting, what I would then return to is what you guys have done, as I understand it, from an epigenetic standpoint, is you've said, hey, wait a minute, guys. Clearly, those mice that are separated from their parents and have no memory of that bad smell from four generations ago are still carrying that around. Maybe we need to look at this from a totally different perspective, from a consciousness perspective, from a somehow consciousness is being drawn through the generations in some way we don't understand, and let's kind of address that directly, right? So that's what you guys are doing. Give people a sense for the nuts and bolts of the counseling session that they go through when they experience systemic family constellations. Because I did it with you in San Diego, and it takes a little bit of letting your guard down because it's a little bit unusual. I mean, it's kind of ritualistic and you're kind of standing in these different places and representing different family members. And then you guys are doing what amounts to kind of a combination of and an interesting merging of traditional therapy and talking and asking and probing, and at the same time doing some channeling slash mediumship stuff. So give people a sense for what that's all about and how you guys do it.
Before I go right there, I just want to kind of tie back to what you said before, and then we'll jump into this last question about the connection to epigenetics, kind of the flow through for that. It necessitates bringing someone into a model that looks like Sheldrake's morphic fields. And there's other versions of it, and not necessarily that he's got it all mapped out. But essentially, I think he does have it all mapped out. And if you kind of flip the question, if you said that what is contained in Signs Set Free or Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, if that was the mainstream, if people kind of just got with that and recognized that this what comes after the argument between the materialists and the consciousness as a field phenomenon, people, if that argument could finally find some movement and the awareness that consciousness is fundamental, that it's a field, it's not produced by the brain, if that became mainstream, then the question is, okay, what kind of therapies are we going to have that are going to be in alignment with the understanding that morphic fields exist?
Exactly. Perfectly well said. So how do you go about, let's say you're at that point, how do you go about answering that question?
So, I mean, we have a simple, I mean, the method is fairly simple. You know, when we worked with you, Alex, you recognize you came for 30 minutes and we kind of hijacked you into a process. So it did take some adjustment on your part. You know, most people that come to us are coming to us for a session. They're not coming to us for a conversation and then finding themselves in a session. And I really appreciate your willingness to go there with us.
People typically come with intention and with an issue, and oftentimes when they come to us, they've exhausted many options. It's very rare that somebody's interested in this process before they've found that everything else isn't working. And so that's something that Dan and I just in and of itself would like to shift in people's awareness, so that this doesn't become this last resort.
So walk people through, though. Walk people through. So, you know, because the positive thing is, in a very small way, and I like the way you kind of corrected me, Dan, because I think you're right. We have to acknowledge that the mainstream is not moving in a really noticeable way. That steamship is still heading off in this direction. But that there is a small and growing number of people who are seeking alternative ways of incorporating in this other larger reality that you're talking about. So as you talked about, you need to go get a past life regression or a medium reading. So let's shift and tell people, because it is really interesting in a way what you're doing. Tell people briefly what's going to happen when they make the leap and say, you know what, I want to give this thing a try, systemic family constellations, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to walk in and I'm going to do it. Give them a high level nuts and bolts of what's going to happen.
They come to us with an intention or an issue, and we typically talk about that. Sometimes we're working with people by phone, by Skype, or in person. So we spend the first, 10 minutes, 15 minutes talking about whatever the issue is. And we're working in a series of rounds, typically three rounds. In the first round, we quiet our minds, we close our eyes, and we connect with our breath. We open the doors of our heart to the gates of the client's hearts. And we basically are just breathing with our client. We feel for the threads that trace from this moment into the distant past. And in the tune-in, we're in contact with the consciousness beyond the ordinary. So we're in contact with consciousness after death in the client's system and in consciousness of the greater whole. In the second round, we step into the fields of consciousness. So we stand up and before having the client, oftentimes we're doing this in group, sometimes we're doing this individually. So before the client stands, Dan and I actually stand up and step into the field that's already present. In a way, our constellation is walking around with us everywhere we go. You go into a grocery store, you're walking with the constellation of consciousness surrounding you. So when we stand up, we're standing into the person's fields of consciousness, and we're just feeling for what's active, what's there, what's in the room with them. They literally arrive when called by the client's issue, and we substantiate the root of trauma and try to make embodied contact with the living children.
One of the reasons why this, as we say it, it sounds so obscure and esoteric, is the warriors that you referred to earlier, Alex, that were up to their elbows in blood, that they always persecuted and slaughtered the people that had this knowledge. We've had over almost 2,000 years since the time of the Romans. The interview that you did on Caesar's Messiah and the way that the Romans spread Christianity through Europe, that when all those soldiers came, the priests came next, and whoever had this knowledge of being able to access these fields of consciousness were snuffed out and killed. There were the witch hunts in 15, 16, 1700s, where there was a purposeful campaign of extermination against people that had this knowledge. And now, centuries later, you can just feel the fear that comes up. Part of the adverse reaction that you or any sensible person has to the idea of stepping into a knowing field and making contact with the ancestors is that it brings up a fear of what are people going to say about you? What is going to happen on your job, particularly if you're in a medical profession or a licensed therapy or working in academia? It's a capital punishment. It's a capital punishment event.
And in that first round, what we're finding is we're building clients' trust because we know very little about their story. We've only spent 10 to 15 minutes with them hearing their issue. We close our eyes, we breathe with them, and in a minute we start to report back what the truth of their conflict is. And then, we might even talk about their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents that we've made contact with in their hearts. And they look at us like, how is it possible that you knew that information? But it's typically in tune. 99% of the time it's typically in tune. And it really depends on the openness of the client as well as the intensity of their intention. If their intention is strong, the process works. If there isn't much of an intention, the process is not going to work as well because the consciousness beyond death isn't really interested in being present or working with us if there isn't something to do. So that there's a way where this consciousness is coming present in service to healing the generations that are alive.
See, guys, I'm with you. I'm with you on all that stuff. And, you guys are talking about so many of the things that I think are super interesting to me personally. What I'm wondering, though, is, it does sound esoteric. It does sound New Agey. And there's some of that that you can't avoid. We're talking about mediumistic communication here. But on the other hand, I think what I experience with you guys and what I want you guys to be able to convey is this as a next step beyond family therapy, you know? And that if I was in, and I'm experiencing problems with my family because I got a family, you know, families are problems, mm-hmm. right? So everybody has problems with their families. So what I want to try and help people understand is that, you know, if you just accept that this family dynamic thing is really kind of weird and accept that weird on just the basis of how we experience it, accept that there is this intergenerational thing that we all get in touch with that, right? Like we're just saying, we're like, God, why am I saying exactly what my mom said? Why am I doing exactly what my dad did? So if we accept that, and then we mix in the epigenetics thing, and then we mix in after-death communication, then we come to what you guys have done, which is synthesize that together in a way that I think is it should be easy for people to step into and say, hey, doesn't this make sense in a way? You know, if I loosen up my kind of hang-ups about that I'm talking to mediumistically, doesn't this make sense? And I have to stand in these weird places. But, hey, doesn't that kind of make sense, too, that I can kind of bring that intergenerational aspect to my being that I never think very much about? I can bring it down to a physical basis. I'm standing here. Now I'm standing here. Now I'm standing there. So that's what I want to try and convey to people. And I don't know quite how to do it. And I think, but what I don't want to do is, I think you guys are jumping into some of the finer aspects of it that I'm sure are struggling, are you know, frustrating for you because you're dealing with it on a day-to-day basis in terms of what people are saying. But how can we get back to just helping people understand this from a way that you know, it isn't such a huge, jarring leap once they make the leap? I love what you said about, you know, Dan, you said that about, you know, if you read Rupert Sheldrake and you say, you know, this makes a lot of sense. My dog does seem to wait for me, and that's a pretty darn reasonable explanation of it. You know, and then there's all these other experiments, too, that they've done with the little birds that find the milk things and all that. Yeah, I'm on board. Tell me how we might use that. And then you guys pop up and say, well, here's how you might do it.
So, you know, we worked with somebody in Ireland. We worked with somebody when we were in Ireland at this intensive. And during our process, you know, he had a cutoff with his daughter. He hadn't talked to his daughter in, you know, 4 to 5 years. One of the bases of, you know, part of the origins of the family constellation modality is existential, is kind of this existential therapy with Virginia Satir. And she came up with, do you want to speak about this, Representative?
No, you go on.
She came up with representative perception, where, you know, she wanted to do family therapy. She wanted to work with the entire family. And oftentimes one family member, particularly the family member that needed to be in the circle, that needed to be in the session, wouldn't show up. And so she eventually started to have assistants sit in and represent the family member that wasn't showing up.
So she'd just take one of her assistants, somebody walking through the hallway, and say, hey, come sit in this chair. You play the brother because he didn't show up today. And we really think he's the cause of this problem.
Exactly. And what she found is as somebody was sitting there, as one of her assistants was sitting there, knew nothing about the family, knew nothing about the problem of the family, didn't, you know, have any information, he or she would start to resemble even just the way the person would sit or the body mannerisms and then would start to speak in the family therapy session as if he or she was completely representing the family member that was missing. It was just incredibly in tune.
And why might that work? What's just kind of an ordinary explanation for that? I mean, because I can think of a couple, you know. I mean, one, there's just a physical aspect to it that we can point to and relate to, we can look at. There's also the if we want to go one level deeper, there's the energy. If we want to go one level deeper, maybe there's this field. But there could be possible reasons why that works, but we don't even have to venture very far into the far out there land to see why that might be effective, right?
That's not the far out there land. Emily's getting to the far out there land. That was just kind of teeing it up. So it's not, it doesn't have to be that far out, but it assumes that there's, that the assistant is able to embody the consciousness of the person they're representing, and that consciousness is not locked into the person's brain, that the consciousness of whoever they're representing is that there's a field of consciousness that our bodies have the capacity to receive, transmit, and differentiate different individuals' consciousness, and that we can tune into it and basically represent another person. Our bodies are these receivers and transmitters of consciousness.
Right. So, and that's pretty far out there. But then again, it isn't that far out there. What you're saying is that we're all mediumistic. We're
absolutely all
constantly receiving and transmitting this greater consciousness. So that's kind of on the far out there speculative side. But the other side, it's just a kind of practical aspect of when we stand one place, when we move our body, it affects our brain and our consciousness differently. So there's also those reasons associated with it. But I'm dragging on the story too far, so please continue, Emily.
So, you know, where I was going with it is in our, when we run a group workshop, we ran this group workshop in Ireland. This man who's, you know, a well-renowned family therapist spoke and said, I'm here because I have a relationship with my daughter. I'd like to heal. It was just him that showed up for the workshop. And he said, I'd like to heal my relationship with my daughter. She hasn't talked to me in 5 years. And she's, you know, angry with making these accusations of things I've done to her and that I don't remember doing. And we're in this kind of standoff. And so we did a process where somebody in the group represented his daughter. She knew nothing about his daughter. He shared very little. That was about the gist of what he shared. And she represented his daughter. They stood up and they talked and they basically completely reported their problems in their current existing relationship. And then we just worked each generation. We had somebody stand up and represent the mother, his mother and his father. Somebody stand up and represent his mother's parents and his father's parents. And eventually, you know, we had 20 people standing in the room, and it was a really profound process where he found this trauma that occurred between his grandparents and his great grandparents. And it was his great grandfather and his grandmother that were in conflict. They resolved their conflict in this outward communication between two complete strangers. This was an American man, and it was in Ireland. So these Irish people, you know, spoke the problems. And the next day, his daughter called him, and their relationship began its process of healing. So he hadn't heard from her in 4 to 5 years. So we bring that up, like, you know, she knows nothing about what occurred. She wasn't present in the workshop, but there's a consciousness that exists in his field and in her field that's connected, even though, you know, they have not been in contact on a physical level. So I bring that up as one of the amazing aspects of this type of a modality is that you don't actually have to know anything about your family. You don't have to have your family present for family therapy. There's so many families that the family members are not willing to come or to do the work. And as long as one person is willing to show up, the systemic entanglements can begin to heal.
Awesome. Thank you. That was awesome. The stories are super helpful. Dan, go back and walk us through again, what someone would observe, maybe from the outside, of what's going on during a session. I think it's particularly interesting to people, this idea of standing in these different places. So tell people in really simple terms how that works. And Emily just gave an example of the eventual outcome and how that can be extremely, unbelievably effective in some of the cases, just hundreds and hundreds of cases that you guys have experienced. But what does it look like from an outsider? Somebody looks and sees what's going on. Describe that.
People come to us with problems, but we work from their intentions, not from their problems. So we're always asking people, they're telling us what their issue is or their problem, but the question we ask is, what is your intention? What is the forward movement? What is the future that you're trying to manifest? And we're actually working in service of that. Not in service of understanding the problem or in a way even fixing the problem primarily. We're actually working from the question of where do you want to go forward? And we have an assumption that between where they are and where they're trying to go, there's a block. There's some kind of block or burden or restraint that is interfering with their ability to move forward in that way. And the question is, who is the block? And the answer generally will be that the block is an ancestor. The block is a person from the family lineage whose consciousness remains active in the person in such a way that they are interfering with that movement forward.
And even so, if they've never met them or don't even know they exist sometimes, right?
Quite possibly.
The origin of the block is identified in the symptom. So somebody might say, my block is my depression, my anxiety, my relationship conflict. And instead of us asking what is causing the anxiety or the depression, we ask who is the anxiety? Who do you hold this this loyalty with in your family legacy?
So with that assumption, we then have a secondary assumption or a following assumption is that the information is available in the field of consciousness that inhabits us and surrounds us. That, you know, near-death studies has demonstrated quite amply that consciousness in some way survives death. That the work of Dean Radin and other researchers in the area of telepathy and other non-ordinary consciousness has demonstrated that human beings have the ability to communicate telepathically. There's presentience. There's those other qualities that are intrinsic to the human being. So we're working with those. We're not necessarily trying to convince people of it. I think the convincing has been done very adequately by hundreds of researchers over quite a long period of time, but we're working with that. So our human bodies have the capacity to interact with those fields of consciousness and to identify the answer to the question of who is the anxiety. We have two ways of accessing it. One we call tuning in, where we close our eyes and breathe and open our hearts. And we open our hearts to awareness with that question, and information comes to us. It's ordinary. If it wasn't so attacked, people wouldn't think it was so strange. The reason that it is considered to be so foreign and esoteric is the weight of the attack that is placed against it, that you can tell the power of something by the force it takes to suppress it. And what we're describing is just built in. Evolution gave us this ability, and religion and science has done everything it can to take it away. So
this is good. The first step is, what's the change you want? The next step is, who is the block? So rather than the kind of traditional therapeutic, what are you feeling, what are you thinking, the question is, who is the block? Who in your ancestral lineage is the block? So now, and then you're kind of tuning in and you're opening yourself up to the greater consciousness to answer that question. Now, what are some of the kind of procedural things, operational things that are going to happen? I'm trying to get to this thing where you stand in these different places, because I think people mm-hmm. will find that really interesting. So just continue, Dan. Tell me what's next.
So we can tune in or we can stand up. We can do standing representation, which is what Emily was describing, Virginia Satir's work. And that involves people just standing. You put your arms at your side and eyes open, and you just perceive. And you can move around and actually inhabit or stand in the place of a person. We can work our way through the lineage. Stand in the place of your mother, stand in the place of your father, of your grandparents. And you can feel sometimes that someone's missing, or that there's somebody else who kind of wants to be present, who is not in that direct lineage, but we're able to perceive, and this is like we can do it, but anybody can do it. And this ancestor that's related to the block comes through. They present themselves to our awareness.
So and we build this constellation of family members, and then you start filling it in with the purpose of affecting this change that people want.
You fill it in to you actually create a family map in a way by standing in all the different family members' places and looking for where is the conflict that hasn't been resolved, where is the symptom that you're experiencing with the client is experiencing, who who is that in the system? So when we stand and we create this family map, we're actually also mapping the emotional traumas and legacies of the family that have been inherited and that are causing disturbance in our client. And then we basically need to look for what's unresolved and how to heal it.
And Dan, when we met in San Diego, you said that you're a scientist. I can tell that. And you have that kind of background and that mindset. And I think I hear some of your frustration in trying to marry your scientific mind with this stuff that's hard to pin down scientifically. But you related to me that you've collected a fair amount of data on your patients and tried to track your success rate kind of from a black box standpoint. They came, they had a problem, I followed them up, and the problem was resolved. And you've found it to be pretty effective, right?
The research that I've done of just, you know, collecting case studies and surveying of people that we've worked with that Emily and I work with, and we kind of track. We're not continuing to do the therapy with them, but we track and we get feedback and we do these formal surveys. And it seems like 80% of the people that we work with report that the issue that they presented originally has resolved or has made significant progress. And 20% of the people answer either that they can't answer that question, they don't know, or that it's about the same. Very few people say that it's gotten worse. The way that it's not scientific, the way we're doing the collection and the sampling, so there's a likelihood that there are some people that have gotten worse that may not be reporting. I don't know that, but from the reports that we get, people, don't report that their issues have gotten worse. Generally, it's either neutral or 80% of the people say that their issues have gotten better, and many say that they're fully resolved, or they'll say what issue. But they very rarely ascribe it to the constellation. Some do, and many of them say that the problem has gone away, just either by itself or for some other reason, but we're kind of tracking just that question: did it get better, stay the same, or get worse? And don't know. Those are the kind of the four points that we're using.
Now, one of the things I found really interesting and different about what you're doing, and I think it's exciting in a way because it really is this next generation of extended consciousness therapy. Because I don't know how to say this other than it's kind of non-evidential in terms of the actual process. And I think that's great, because if you go to a medium or you watch Long Island Medium on TV, what the big benefit that is being sold is this is going to be evidential that there is an afterlife. And that then the cherry on the top is they're okay in the afterlife, or this issue is resolved in the afterlife. But the big selling point is it's evidential that there isn't an end. And what's different about your therapy is because you do merge together traditional therapeutic techniques in terms of talking and interacting with the client in a way that I think can be very helpful. It's not evidential in that way. In terms of like if someone goes into this and says, I'm going to prevent any kind of cold reading by not giving any information or this and that. It's not like that. You're right in the middle of it saying, yeah, maybe that ties to this and this. And then you're trying to tie that in and you're working together with the client in a way that presupposes that all this stuff is possible and that there is this greater consciousness and that we are going to lay out this map. And I like that actually.
In a way that, people go to therapy to talk about their current day problems, and they don't think about talking about their parents or grandparents or great grandparents' problems. And when it comes up in therapy, they're willing to go there if it's in service to their problems, but it's not necessarily what they're walking the door with. And then others go to mediums to go get readings, and they come in, not wanting to say anything and just wanting validation that the presence of their ancestors is with them, that they're not alone in this universe. And yet they sometimes you hear things in those readings and you don't really know what to do with them, or why it's, you know, so my father's present. What does that mean for me? You know, what am I supposed to do about that?
My uncle stepped forward instead of my father. You know, what does that mean? You're right. Those questions go completely unanswered.
Right. And there it is. And then you wonder what to do with it. So what we're doing is actually going one step further in both areas. In therapy, we're taking their initial difficulty that they feel powerless over and kind of helpless around, and looking for resources beyond human scale and form. And we're looking for, you know, the hidden answers. What are the hidden solutions? And then on the other side, we're taking the information that's there in their consciousness, or in the consciousness after death of their loved ones. And we're integrating it to find what healing is there for you. You know, what does actually the message mean, and how can we go a little further with it to find, you know, who isn't speaking in the messages, or why so-and-so didn't show up? Who's being excluded from the system that wants to be heard or seen or acknowledged? So it's just a deeper way of working with both sides.
Dan, this is maybe a little bit out there, but, you know, if we accept what you're doing and we accept the reality of it, what does this say about our relationship with the deceased? I mean, in a way, it's hard to even fathom. I mean, we have enough problems dealing with the relationships of the people who are here with us living. Now you're telling us in a way that we have to worry about the unseen intergenerational relationships four generations back with some grandfather I never met, you know? I mean, have you given any thought to that?
I mean, definitely, that's a great question. And it's at the core of what we're doing is that the ancestors are not all okay. That some of the ancestors are okay, and they're in a loving relationship with us. But when the ancestors are not okay, and often they are not, they show up in our lives as our symptoms. They show up as our blocks and our burdens and our restraints, and they are using that as a way of calling attention to themselves, calling attention to something that needs to be seen. And as we resist looking for what that might be, the symptoms become more and more activated and more persistent and stronger. So they're, you know, we're not giving readings to people. We're not giving people reassurance that everything's okay. We're asking the question, who is your anxiety? And very often it's the remedy is that there's something that needs to be seen. Someone needs to be seen and to be connected with. And when that connection is made and the fate that they suffer is recognized and acknowledged and honored, then the message is delivered, and then the dead can be okay, and the symptom then evaporates like a wispy cloud.
But there's a flip side to that as well, in that the living have invisible loyalties. You know, we are the grandchildren of people who have had family traumas. And in our hearts, no matter what our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents have experienced or done, there's an invisible loyalty. There's a hidden loyalty of love. We want the flow of love. Just like a flower growing on a vine, we want to stay connected to a healthy vine. We don't want we don't want to grow from a severed vine. So there's a way where we are also reaching into the roots of our system to grow and to be resourced. And when there's a pain, we are looking to heal that pain. We're looking to, you know, to heal the sever in the vine. And so that there's also the living moving towards the dead, to find a way forward. And in those invisible loyalties, we need to find the root of our pain.
Now, Dan and Emily, you two are two of the leading figures in this field, and you're really kind of pushing things forward in some amazing ways. But your work, I guess, a lot of times is not only working directly with clients, but also working with other practitioners who want to learn how to bring this therapy to their clients. How does that work kind of practically in your practice? I mean, what are you guys doing? What's the playing field like?
We have an immersion program. It's a 9-month program. We're not training therapists to do what we do. We're not actually training anybody to do what we do, but we're helping people. We're teaching people how to be able to do what they do, how to be able to integrate this awareness, being able to open their hearts and understand the maps of consciousness beyond the ordinary, how to understand the interaction between the consciousness of the living and the consciousness of the deceased, and also how to then be in relationship with spiritual consciousness that comes through ancestral consciousness. There's a lot in a lot of spiritual practices are bypassing what we're calling the second dimension of consciousness.
The second dimension, again, is this intergenerational kind of thing that's going on, right?
Exactly. So we are doing an integration.
So this immersion, so explain for again, Dan, so the immersion program is, are you working with therapists who want to learn this? Are you doing that? And then you're doing this immersion program. And then who is the immersion program for?
Our current program, we have a physician, we have therapists, we have a Buddhist teacher, we have an organizational development specialist who's working in a university setting and in a women's leadership program, et cetera. So we're working with people across a range of professions and a range of ages and backgrounds. We worked last year with one of the leading figures in the Black Lives Matter movement, who's become a leader in that movement and are articulating a way of waging love on white supremacy and integrating an understanding of how the Scots-Irish and the Africans coexist within the African-American community and how to promote a better way of living between the Black community and white communities in regard to the way that trauma and violence continues to be perpetuated within the Black community.
Okay, so when somebody like that comes and participates in the immersion program, what do you anticipate they're going to do when they get out? Are they going to go create constellations for people, or they're just going to incorporate this kind of awareness, knowledge, in more general sense into what they do?
Some people are coming because they are working to heal themselves, to feel more whole and complete in themselves, and then to bring their work, their purpose, their vision into the world. Others are coming to learn a technique that to access consciousness beyond human scale and form. The physician that's in our program is interested in bringing this into the ER, in bringing this into his work with environmental activism.
How would he bring that into the ER? I'm just trying to understand. I mean, I love what you're saying there, but I mean, it's kind of hard to really bring that down to you guys do something that seems to work and seems to be effective for people, right? So I'm an ER physician. I come in. What are my hopes and expectations in terms of what I'm going to do with that for myself? I mean, other than healing myself, you know, I heal myself and then I'm a better person. I'm just wondering. I'm just, you know, maybe we don't even have to include this in if it's not important, but.
Well, I mean, there are certain places in an ER that it fits. If someone comes in with a stab wound, you know, our work is not really relevant to that. That's just on the cellular level of stemming the bleeding and stitching it up. But if someone comes in with a stab wound that is fatal and they're dying there and their loved ones are in the hallway wanting to know what's happening, then it could actually be very helpful to be in tune with these fields of life and death and to help ease the trauma for the survivors in such situations or car accidents where people are being brought into the hospital and dying in the ER surrounded by their loved ones. And it's a rather brutal and traumatizing way to die. It's a great place to survive. It's the best place to survive, but in a lot of ways, it's the worst place to die. And so there are moments where this awareness could actually be very beneficial.
What I'm taking away from what you're saying there is it's mainly the tune in skills that someone would take away in that regard, right?
I would say tune in skills. There's also, he can also use these for helping families come to resolution around decision making for the patient. If the patient isn't able to make their own decisions and the family's in conflict, you know, helping a family step into the conflict in a different way. It could be also accessing information within the operating room that's outside of what can be reported in that moment by that patient. This isn't sound and valid yet in the ER. So it's something that's happening on a different level. This particular physician has a very strong spiritual orientation, and maybe calling in resources of a father or a grandfather to be present with his patient while he's holding the patient in his care.
You're trying to help them tune into their natural mediumistic abilities and develop those further. Would that be fair, or is there something?
That's a part of it. We're teaching people how to make this perception ordinary in their lives, wherever they're working, to be able to integrate it. It's a 9-month program. We have 4 3-day meetings on Martha's Vineyard where we gather together and we do some very intense, deep work looking at macro and micro ways that that people's problems and sufferings come together. So we can be working with a mother and her disabled child, and how that's interfacing with the school system, and at the same time, so that's very micro. But in the same process, we're also looking at these larger social forces of fascism, of the corruption of public education, of bureaucracies, and how those fields are also interacting and streaming down to this one family's difficulty in trying to access the resources for their child.
Great. What are people going to find at the website that they might want to pay attention to?
They can visit our website to schedule a free private consultation with us. In a 30-minute consultation, we tune into their fields of consciousness. We give them some feedback as to whether or not we can help them or refer them to someone who could, if we find that in the consciousness it isn't quite what we do. You can visit our website for workshops, for events, to learn more about our 9-month program.
Mm-hmm. We're traveling around the country. We have workshops, weekends, 2- and 3-day workshops set up around the country. We're going to be at the Kripalu Center in Massachusetts in March. We're doing a training for therapists in Connecticut. We are doing in the summer, in July, we do a family constellations intensive, 5-day intensive with other trainers. That's for about 70 people. So information about the different events that we have going on. And there's articles and videos and, you know, for people that just kind of may not want to interact with us personally, but are looking for information and want to kind of understand this better, and links to other sites. And, you know, there's a lot of practitioners doing this work in the States and around the world. And there's a growing body of written and recorded information about it for people who want to access that, learn more.
Well, I think it's really awesome what you're doing, and I think it's really brave. I think it's the next psychotherapeutic work. It's where things have to go, and I think it's also where we didn't get a chance to talk about this. But you know, my wife is a therapist, trained therapist, and she does forensic work now. But that's, you know, she used to be in private practice and stuff, and we've always had these conversations over the years. I think the most skilled therapists have always done some form of this. Because that's why it works, you know, that's what works. So the fact that y'all have attempted to kind of corral it, formalize it a little bit, and measure it and move it forward, I think is terrific. And you're to be commended for doing this kind of work.
Thanks so much, Alex. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. I agree. There's a real thirst for this in the psychotherapy community, as there is a tremendous fear about how this would be received for therapists to start working with consciousness beyond the ordinary. In one case, in one sense, people are really thirsty for it or yearning for it very deeply. In the other sense, there's a lot of fear because the machine eats people that do it.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, I mean, you know, just look at the fear from a pragmatic standpoint. The meal that's presented here, systemic family constellations, or the meal that's presented on the other plate, a pile of pills that you're going to have to take for the rest of your life that have all these understood side effects. I mean, it's such an easy choice. I mean, it's like, why would you not try this? If it doesn't work, how are you worse off? If you don't believe it has any effective origins to it, what do you have to lose? I mean, it's like a no-lose situation.
Yeah, I wish, I think the thing that we would like to support the therapeutic community with is just to, you know, to when we come into confrontation with harshly enforced social codes and taboos, how can we move beyond the can'ts, the don'ts, and the shouldn'ts that bind us to materialism and in a way challenge our own belief systems and the medical paradigms to which we once subscribed? We as psychotherapists and healers and visionaries and practitioners, we constantly need to be challenging what we subscribe to, what is possible, what's allowed, and if we're willing to risk belonging, to step out into a paradigm that might be more effective than what we've been trained in.
Yeah. Well, it's been great having you both on, and I wish you best of luck with this work.
Thanks, Alex. It's been so really it's been great talking to you, and I really appreciate really appreciate this conversation, and as you can tell, I really appreciate your show and how you've done the best job of moving this whole conversation forward in so many different interviews with guests from all over. I just have tons of respect for your work.
And we also want to thank the listeners and the community that you've called together to be present for this conversation. You know, this is where it all begins. This is how we learn and grow in humanity, is to be asking these questions, to be challenging our beliefs and the paradigms from which we've been working. So right. Thank you to the listeners who are with us.
Right. And we'll be on the forum if that's I'm assuming that's OK if we kind of jump in on the forum as the discussion gets underway about the show. We'll be glad to participate.
Yeah, I think people really appreciate when guests do that. So, everybody, you can come check out Dan and Emily on the forum, and we can have a good, rousing discussion over there. So thanks again. We'll be in touch, you guys.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks again to Dr. Dan Booth-Cohen and family therapist Emily Volden for joining me today on Skeptico. I have one question to tee up from this interview, and that is, given that after-death communication, in every way that we've tried to measure it, is a reality, how might we expect psychotherapy to change and adapt to incorporate in this new understanding? Dan and Emily have offered us one model, one way that the change might be occurring, but what do you think? Is this really a step in the right direction, or are there better and more effective ways of wandering into this largely uncharted territory? So please do let me know your thoughts on that. And as you heard in this interview, both Dan and Emily will be joining us in the forum if you'd like to ask them a follow-up question. That's an added treat. Of course, the place to get to all of that is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can link on over the forum, or you can, of course, drop me a note on Facebook or send me an email. And, of course, you can go through the website to reach Dan and Emily directly as well. Now, while you're at the Skeptico website, be sure to subscribe to the show if you like. Sign up to our newsletter so you get notified when new shows are coming out. Haven't been super up to date on the newsletter, but I'll try and get more on track with that. And, of course, from there you can access our library of over 300 previous shows of Skeptico that you can download and listen to for free. This was a great show to put together, a great experience for me. It's so cool for me to have met Dan through Skeptico and then to become involved in his work wherever that's going. That's been really cool, and it's such a joy to share all this with you and to get the kind of feedback I get from folks on a daily basis, telling me what the show means for them and telling me that the interaction we're having between me and you is meaningful and useful to you is just tremendously motivating to me and really brings me a lot of satisfaction. So to all of you who are listening, thank you. Stick around. Plenty more to come. But until next time, take care and bye for now.